And welcome back to Real Clear with Dr. Klein, the crossroads of politics and psychology. If you would like to listen to ad-free episodes and have access to daily and weekly releases, essays, and other membership perks, and you also want to help in the production of this program, go to realclearpodcast.com and click subscribe. There are a lot of places in this world where you can put your money, and so I thank you for considering membership to realclearpodcast.com. I hope you enjoy this next episode. Welcome back to Real Clear Podcast with Lucas Klein. I have here for the monthly meeting with Professor Wilfred Riley, Kentucky State University, political science professor and author of excellent books, including Taboo, as well as the forthcoming book called Lies My Liberal Professor Told Me, as well as a very entertaining Twitter account, WillTheBeast360. Is that right?
It's 630, actually. It's my old, it's the zip code for my old neighborhood just outside of Chicago.
Got it. Okay. I suggest people follow you. It's really something to see the things you come up with. So, Professor, this week, I'd like to have us discuss things for about a half an hour. Obviously, there's a lot going on the world stage. And in particular, I want to get your thoughts on what's happening domestically in the United States in response to the war in Israel and Gaza. We've had, for instance, Black Lives Matter put out a meme that was literally a terrorist flying into Israel with a machine gun. We've got students all around the United States marching on behalf of Palestine with signs that say United States or Palestine Infada. We have LGBTQ for Gaza and for Palestine, where they would be killed and thrown off of a roof for their lifestyle, and so on and so forth. So help us understand what's happening right now.
Yeah, I mean, so I think from a political science perspective, I'm not especially surprised by this. Like, I think it was Christina Hoff Sommers who decades ago described a lot of American colleges as quote unquote woke madrasas. The idea is that you're indoctrinated just across the board with a whole bunch of things. And you actually see these in some of the online flyers for the pro-Palestine rallies, like Palestinian liberation is reproductive justice, is native decolonization, is Black Lives Matter, is real feminism. And when you actually look at the war, like, you know, some Hamas rapist exchanging gunfire with like a bearded IDF soldier, I mean, none of this makes any sense at all. But this is something that's really been kind of intubated into the heads of a lot of young Americans for, what, 4 or 5 decades now? So, I mean, when you see the large rallies and so on, that's not really shocking. I mean, the initiating event for Black Lives Matter was that, you know, a drug addict who happened to be African-American died while he was in police custody. And that certainly was an example of great policing. But why would that create a national frenzy that led to the deaths of, I believe, 38 people, including heroes like David Dorn? Well, because the tender was already there. It had been there for a while. I don't want to blah blah on this too much, but we're seeing the same thing here. And the final point I would make is just understand that just like we do with the hard right, where I don't think your field or mine really has any patience for people that are Nick Fuentes saying the Holocaust didn't happen or something like that. Right. I mean, it's the same thing on the hard left, except there are more of them. I mean, when people say gas the Jews or, you know, Yehud, you can't hide, we want genocide. I mean, they're not kidding.
Yeah, as happened in Australia, that's what Professor is referring to. Gas the Jews was present as a slogan at a rally in Australia.
Yeah, it's happened a couple of times. I mean, it was on Twitter today. I think it was one of the University of California schools. The original tweet's apparently been taken down after some protests from the college about how often this was said. But people were actually chanting, you can't hide. We want Jewish genocide. And, you know, I'll retract that if it turns out not to be real, but it's on the page right now.
So what is real is that 32 student groups at Harvard signed a petition saying that they held Israel solely responsible for what happened.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely true. And that's not even contested. I mean, yeah. And they were large groups as well. I mean, you had Amnesty International. You had, I believe, the Harvard Radcliffe Women's Forum. You had the Muslim Students Association or Law Students Association. So, I mean, people were trying to minimize this a bit, like, oh, dumbass college kids. But I mean, that's hundreds or thousands of people at Harvard University, which is still the nation's, you know, number two or three institution. So there's really no way to downplay this. like the paraglider symbol that you described directly refers to the current back and forth war. I mean, the Palestinians were not previously a people known for hang gliding. You know, the paragliders were how they broke the border. They flew over the defensive fences, which, I mean, was a well-planned attack. I mean, had it been directed strictly at military targets, I mean, I think this we might be learning about this in, you know, military science classes. But that's what people are commemorating. They're commemorating the beginning of a violent war.
Right. And moreover, there were obviously intelligence failures and so forth, and that's interesting, too. With respect to what the United States does policy-wise regarding these anti-Jewish sentiments, these clearly Nazi-esque, not Nazi-esque, Nazi sentiments, what do you think needs to happen in terms of policy in the United States, if anything?
Well, I mean, I think stateside from Joe Biden on down, I mean, people need to be absolutely clear that we're not going to tolerate a resurge in violent anti-Semitism. And this applies to, quote unquote, Islamophobia as well. But I mean, if you look through the 10, 15 incidents that have happened so far, I mean, there was something that I just heard about, I mean, on the radio, really, coming from police broadcasts where a nut apparently broke into someone's house and attacked a woman's husband screaming, "You're a Jew, die, you're from Israel."
He's in Los Angeles. That's right.
Yeah, there's clearly a unidirectional tilt to these assaults. And again, I mean, obviously, I'm on the center right politically. I have a bias here, you know, caveat. But the elephant in the room, really, as we've obsessed about right-wing violence for the past 4 or 5 years, is that there's been constant extreme left-wing violence. I mean, we've seen mobs in the streets during the George Floyd riots, the Jacob Blake riots, where there's a little gun
battle.
Mostly
peaceful, Will. Sorry, mostly peaceful.
Yeah, I mean, most people were not shot at during the Jacob Blake riots. I mean, it's just, you know, Rittenhouse and the guys that were gunning for him.
Right. But it's saying that the night that O.J. Simpson killed his wife, that it was a mostly peaceful night, and which was true, with the exception of about five minutes.
Except for his wife and Ronnie Goldman. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what we're talking about with mostly peaceful, right? I mean, so like people will continually say only, I think it's 7.9% of Black Lives Matter marches turn into violent riots. But that's an insane figure. I mean, like that's like saying, you know, if 7.9% of dates turn into brutal domestic violence, I mean, we'd call the whole system off and go back to courting. I mean, that's not acceptable. Like 0% of, you know, Democratic or Republican national conventions turn into, right, into brawls these days. So, I mean, I think that this is something we've been seeing. I mean, we see it at the Free Palestine marches where people are chanting for genocide. We saw it during all these riots for years. I mean, again, dozens of people died, $2 billion in damage was done. So I guess just if you're calling out extremism, you can't ignore this giant pachyderm of extremism.
Are college students really that uninformed, dare I say stupid, that they think that Israel is still occupying Palestine? I've heard that from so many people on the left. And it's like, excuse me, that hasn't happened since 2006. What are you talking about?
Yeah, I think there are two things. One is just a lack of knowledge, and the other is kind of this general Gen Z, and especially liberal Gen Z, like comfort with just changing the meanings of words. And I mean, you see this all across the board. I mean, like there are continual online and academic world arguments about whether, you know, X celebrity who has a 19-year-old girlfriend is a pedophile. I mean, yeah. I don't want to get into this territory, but it's just like, no, that's not what it means.
Minor attracted person.
You're not an anything if you're, you know, X years old and your girlfriend is 20. I mean, they're 18 for that matter. It's just, it's the use of terminology beyond what it could possibly mean to make your case or make your point. So the specific thing here, when we're talking about Palestine, yes, I think most people have gotten used to hearing terms like occupation, which means blockade on parts of Gaza, or genocide, which means Israel winning. And they probably do feel that in some way this is unjust. I don't think the average, you know, Vassar sophomore is really that well lettered in international law. So the idea is, yeah, this it's an apart, what is it? An apartheid settler colonial white state practicing genocide against indigenous people. It's just all these terms being completely misused.
That's what I said recently in one of my own podcasts on Real Clear, is that Israel, for the purposes of the violent revolutionary ideology, I'm not calling it woke anymore. I'm calling it violent revolutionary, because that's really what it is at its heart. Israel has to be white and it has to be colonial. Otherwise, there is no Marxist line to be threaded. Palestine has to be the oppressed and Israel has to be the oppressor, right?
Yeah, that's, I mean, I think that's pretty obvious. It's certainly roughly correct. Yeah, the whole argument, none of this is especially deep or especially intelligent. I mean, it's important to realize that Marx and Fanon, and you do, but like Marx and Fanon and all these guys were wrong. They were wrong about every major point. Like, they made empirical social science predictions and none of them happened. Like,
nobody knows who Fanon was. Can you tell my audience who he was?
Franz Fanon, Black Marx, the guy in the colonial world who wrote an entire book about how the real structure of oppression was between kind of the global north, the wealthy countries, and the global south. And who advocate, Franz Fanon is really the first guy to advocate for decolonization. Like, we need to physically remove white people and their infrastructure from our countries, and then we will find utopia. It's worth noting that Fanon and most of these sort of guys were not actually living in the Bundu in their own countries. They were upper middle class kids who were part of the coffee shop scene in Paris. And the whole idea of Pan-Africanism or Pan-Arabism came from these people that were in white countries as popular kids that felt a bit different from the norm. But I mean, the whole argument of all of these philosophies is basically there's an oppressor-oppressed divide, and all differences in performance between groups are due to this divide between oppressor and oppressed. So, I mean, to me, the BLM narrative was always just Marxism with like the white man substituted for the man.
And now we have Marxism with Palestine and Israel, and nobody seems to pay attention to the fact that the reason that Gaza is not successful anymore, let's take, for example, agriculturally, is because when the Jews gave them back that strip of Gaza that they had been occupying, what's the first thing they did? They destroyed the greenhouses that Israel built because it had Jewish fingerprints on them, and they used the tubing for rockets. This is literally what they did.
Yeah, the theory is wrong. Like, the theory behind institutional wokeness is that the explanation for every gap in performance between groups is some kind of oppression. So, like, with BLM and with a lot of the Black activists, the idea is that society is structured to benefit white people over Black people, and that's why you see a lot of problems in the Black community, like fatherlessness. For radical feminists, it's society is structured to benefit men over women, and that's why you see less physical strength among women or less aggression among women, just blah, blah, blah. But through like 15 of these, and the Israel-Palestine debate is thrown into kind of the decolonial frame. Like, society is structured to benefit people who are whiter from certain rich countries, and that's why Palestine's fucked up. Again, it doesn't make any sense. Like, the Arabs overall are wealthier than the Israelis. If you look at the UAE, Dubai, all these people are white to me and to most geneticists, but it's just, it fits the frame. You have to make it work. There's only one argument.
How are you responding to this as a professor, and what's going on in your classes these days?
Well, in the classes, most students really don't care, which I think is a useful reminder, because I mean, we're both decently heavily online. We're doing podcasts and all this. Like, the average person who wants to be a Kentucky State Trooper or something, their position is kind of like, well, I hope they stop killing each other. Like, there's not really a lot of interest in the, you know, history dating back to Bible times of, you know, the region known as Judea and Samaria. So a lot of people don't really care and kind of want the violence to stop when kids are impacted. We do have people that are often of Jewish heritage that are passionately pro-Israel. We have a lot of people that are passionately pro-Palestine just because they're young activists and it's a mostly minority school. Like, I don't mean to be glib, but I don't think most of them really know the history of the establishment of the British protectorate of Transjordan or whatever, but they feel that the other side are more likely to be the bad guys. You know, they're more white, they're more heavily armed.
And so they have the backing of the United States. And if anything has the backing of the United States, it has to be an outpost of the empire. Is that right about it? Yeah.
Yeah. That's actually an extremely insightful point that, like, this ideology at root is a revolutionary ideology. Like, Marxism is not a third world ideology. Marx was, as we both know very well, this old kind of lower upper class Caucasian guy.
Also extremely racist and anti-Semitic, it must be said.
Yeah, of course. I mean, so that also is funny because no one ever deconstructs Marx. Like, when you look at all these like feminist poets that are digging through everything Jefferson ever wrote, looking for secret attraction to Black women or him being.
Well, look at what Kendi did. Kendi found one footnote about Hume, and it was a disgusting footnote, you know, stupid things he said. One footnote in anything Hume ever wrote that was racist. Look at the first page virtually of Marx. He refers to literally N-word Jews.
Yeah, I mean,
it's outrageous. and he survives.
Another thing I will say about this also, like, I'm not offended by the fact that people, before there were any modern rules, did things that we were offended by. I mean, so, like, I'm not really offended by Marx's writing. I mean, this is a guy who lived in an era before indoor plumbing was especially common.
No, it's certainly not my point. But if he survives, how could Hume not survive?
Well, absolutely. I mean, so we shouldn't cancel any of these people, really. I mean, like, if you were to take something, maybe not racism, because there were anti-slavery advocates, abolitionists and all that. But if you were to take the modern attitude that a certain level of homophobia is intolerable, and anyone to demonstrate it should be removed from the libraries and the reading rooms, and you were to really apply that to British, or for that matter, West African or Chinese, Indian, a long tradition thought, you would be left with no pundits of any kind, no generals you could read about, because everyone thought gay anal sex between men, except for the Greeks and some Romans, but was a little weird until the modern era. It might occasionally happen in a military camp. It wasn't something you're supposed to talk about. So again, like, I don't know if Marx was more offensive than most people of his time, but yeah, he was an outspoken racist. He hated black people. He didn't trust Jews. So the point there, though, is that Marxism is not a radical third world ideology. It's a Western revolutionary ideology. And the idea is that all the power relations in our system are bad. So right. Yes, being supported by America would automatically be a negative for a Marxist student radical. That's correct.
If you would like to listen to ad-free episodes and have access to daily and weekly releases, essays, and other membership perks, and you also want to help in the production of this program, go to realclearpodcast.com and click subscribe. There are a lot of places in this world where you can put your money, and so I thank you for considering membership to realclearpodcast.com. Okay, let's stay within the topic of Middle Eastern war, Israel and Gaza, Palestine, and let's talk about a few other things that fall under that domain. I was stunned, and I posted this on my previous podcast this week, to view a video of Joe Biden and John Kirby and Karine Jean-Pierre just outside of Air Force One with a few reporters asking him just a series of basically easy questions. They were just strategy questions. They were not trying to trip him up. This was the clearest example that I have seen so far, this little brief video of Joe Biden off his rocker. I mean, clearly disintegrated. And you saw Jean-Pierre as well as Kirby absolutely fraught with worry that he was unbridled and vulnerable in front of a camera and being asked questions. At one point, Kirby literally says over his shoulder to somebody else, "We've got to stop this." And Biden was simply being asked basic questions. Jean-Pierre tried to bump into him and stop the interview. She awkwardly failed and agitated him. And it looked like Grandpa got angry because people are trying to manage him and he's losing his marbles. What do you have to say about this, especially with respect to what's going on with, is it hyperbole, the next potential World War III?
Well, I mean, that I don't think there's going to be a World War III. I mean, one of the problems with the idea of a world war is that most world powers now have nuclear weapons. I mean, even Israel and Iran do. So I think you're going to see a lot of proxy warring. Like, I think you're going to see Hezbollah come in from the side a little bit more in this Israel conflict. But even with Russia and Ukraine, I mean, everyone's being very, very careful. Like, America is, I mean, I think we've had maybe 20 pairs of boots on the actual ground total. We're not going to fight Russia face to face. So I think that if there was a situation like China or India might use that as an opening to expand their prominence on the global stage. But if it really looked like the USA would come in to support Israel and all the Arab states would come in to support the Palestinians, I think there would be players that would stop that from happening. But I mean, in terms of even just like a war that kills 2 million people wouldn't be good, you know? So I mean, in terms of who we want governing or managing the Ukraine and Palestine conflicts, it's hard to think of a worse option than Joe Biden. Yeah, he's 80 something, I believe. I mean, 80 at least he is. You know, I've tried to avoid saying this because I'm not a medical doctor, but I mean, he's obviously dealing with dementia or something close. He can't talk. I mean, there have been multiple press conferences where he's kind of wandered to the middle of the stage and like shaking hands and then tried to leave because he forgot what he was there for.
Medal of Honor ceremony, he literally just left.
Yeah, I mean, I've got seniors in my family. I mean, we all know what's happening. Like, there was that other time he shook the hand of some very powerful person, the Indian ambassador or some such. And then again, he tried to leave, and he was like, they guided him back into the stage. Like, people from two countries were gently pushing him. So that's not what you want. I mean, the amazing thing to me is that he's running. That he didn't say it's time for a black woman, or like Gavin down there in California has been doing great things. He is openly ready to go. And like once when he's got those amphetamines in him in the morning,
he's not giving it up. Did you see him at the G20 where this is the first time that I think this has ever happened in political history in the United States. The president of the United States was interrupted by his press secretary to whisk him off of the G20 stage. Breathtaking. That has never happened.
There must be protocols in place, I'd imagine. It's just like anything else. I mean, like when you talk about like working in a field like psychology, I mean, I assume there are patients that would have or clients that would have serious drinking problems or substance abuse problems, or major personal issues. And what most people I've known in kind of a civilian role who have these issues do is really manage the public facing presence. Like, it's hard to get a hold of the guy on certain days because they're going to be hungover or they're going to be with the other woman or whatever. And I mean, it's in my group of friends at this point, as we are all are 40 or approaching, there's very little tolerance for that. But like, you all know what it is. Like, hey, Jim's not available today. Well, why not? You know, it's kind of I think that's kind of why Joe's not available. Like when they keep calling these lids, I would assume that every time they call a lid or they whisk him off the stage and he's not seen for usually 4 to 6 hours. You know, any of this stuff, there's probably some medical procedure involved, or he's just not functional. Like,
this is why he rests more than any president in history. I think it was 36%. I think that's the amount of time that he spends in leisure.
The interesting thing is that Trump came pretty close to that, and he was just dicking around playing golf. But the thing is, or was he? Like, Trump is about like 77, 78. So, I mean, with all of these very old men, I mean, no one is not of mortal flesh. The conservative commentator Matt Walsh actually had a good speech about this the other day where he said, you know, I respect Trump. And back in the day, although he was a political op, I even respected Biden. They could talk. But when you get to 80, you're just 80. Like, why is it Biden making sense? Because he's 80. And I think that's correct. And I think you probably saw a bit of that with Trump, like where people are saying kind of we need to get him out to the golf course for either one of them for a day. Let him relax. Let him, you know, take a couple pills.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, how can he go that hard that long? The answer is he can't. Yep. Right? He's out there in a suit in 90 degree weather over some of his rallies. He's 77 years old and he's just romping through it. And you wonder, what the hell is going on with this guy? There's no way he can keep this up.
What I would assume with both guys is that they have a really good doctor on the team. It's like the old joke in the NFL, like the real star is the team doctor, where you see guys jumping around, and, you know, they played a Thursday game, then they played a Sunday game, I mean, like next week.
They're injecting cortisol in the knee, you know, getting them amped up. So this is a bit off topic, but in wondering who is going to be taking the helm of this disaster going forward in the Middle East and domestically, Trump is in trouble. It looks he really might go to prison. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know if he's going to go to prison just because of the practical problems with that. I mean, I think there's a pretty solid chance that we'll see a Republican president, whether it's him or DeSantis. It's because, I mean, the Republican field is in terrible shape, but then they're running against the guy we're talking about, like potentially dying. So it's one of those things. When I mentioned my circle of buddies, one of the guys in the group chat is an Indian physician who's kind of a monarchist. Like, you need strong leaders. You know, I'm not going to try to do an accent, but like, you need strong leaders. You need people that'll, you know, hold things together. And he actually described a Biden-Trump race as an argument against democracy, where he said, like, you guys, you Westerners constantly talk shit about, like, the old Rajas, the old chiefs over in your motherland. We're teasing each other.
And here, like, we are.
No, but like, yeah, the old Arab Shahs. But like, what are you doing? You're running two 80-year-old crooks against each other. Like, both of them are going to be in jail. And an argument for that, like, are the most charismatic people who won't leave even when their charisma is gone, who have these fan bases, are those the best people to run the country? Or would, you know, pulling Big Chief out of retirement be a good thing in many cases? That's a strong argument.
I have compassion for it, and I urge everyone to have compassion for your fellow citizen. These are, in my opinion, not valid choices for president. And so you're going to have to vote for Biden or Trump. And I have compassion for people. you know, these are not optimal choices. This is sort of a la Eric Weinstein's point as well. He doesn't view these as reasonable choices for president. You might view one as better than the other in various metrics and so forth. But overall, I mean, come on, this is pathetic. Don't you think?
There's a very serious possibility that they both could face felony indictments. I mean, like, you're talking about the Hunter Biden scandal. It's not the biggest political scandal ever, but it honestly, at the presidential level, would be in the top five. I mean, like, this is the president's son is a if you phrase this in just nonpartisan fashion, the president's son is a famous international executive who traded on his family name, probably illegally, if you look at like the power brokerage laws and so on, for years. Went around the world rounding up these fat bags of money. Joe Biden was aware of every step of this. Joe Biden called him 1,016 times or whatever. Joe Biden was emailing him from all these fake email addresses that we now know were his, with names like, you know, what is it? Peter Hefty, like this crazy, like two bros talking kind of stuff. And while Hunter Biden was doing this, there's this added element of he's partying with these potentially trafficked Eastern European prostitutes. He's doing like Marilyn Manson levels of cocaine. There's a video where he weighs 21 grams is a lot of coke. Like, I went to college. Like, he's doing all this. And you have these questions like, was this stuff on Air Force Two? You know, so I mean, I don't think Biden's going to be able to escape that for long. Like, I think as a popular Democratic president, given what our media is, he probably would have been. But he's now fading in popularity. There are other candidates. I mean, so I think that there's a real possibility of both candidates actually facing impeachment level on up legal procedures at the time the election's going on. So, yeah, that is very problematic.
At a time where they need to be sensitively cued into geo-military and political and economic dynamics, it seems as though we have two people capped at the knees by their boondoggles. Not exactly a great time for this to be happening. So, Professor Riley, what else do you think in the last few minutes we have remaining, you could tell the audience as to what you're paying attention to right now, politically, geopolitically, et cetera?
Well, I think one thing I'm paying attention to is I don't think we're going to have World War III, but the potential dynamic shifts in the international order. So, I mean, remember just, 15 years back, 20, you had a friend, Dr. Fukuyama writing the book, The End of History. You know, the argument was that the Western liberal model had become so dominant that everyone else was going to adopt that. And there'd be no more issues. There'd be few major wars. I mean, right now you have the rise of China, which is an autocratic, almost mercantilist system. You've got the rise of India, which is a giant, diverse democracy like us, but four times that size and non-Western, non-white, at least. They've picked up a lot from the West. I mean, you have the great Arab states, which, you know, built a mountain, the Burj Al Arab, and are now competitive with anyone in the world. So the idea that we were going to see this one unipolar future where everyone held hands and sung kumbaya, not really. I mean, like, the Eastern Euros are going back to their old tradition from the Russians and Mongols and sort of conquest. Russia just straight up took over a country, or tried to. The Ukrainians are fighting hard with our help. But I mean, so that's the thing that you notice. And because it's this kind of time of testing, you're seeing large wars like Israel versus the Arabs, Russia versus Ukraine, Armenia and Azerbaijan. I mean, that's potentially going to end in a genocide. Like, actual countries, Sudan, are fighting in a way that hasn't been the case for decades. So, I mean, that's something I'm obviously keeping an eye on, because at some point, I mean, three or four of those countries are probably capable of dropping a sun bomb on one another. So if that happens once, I mean, that's a dramatic change in the world order. And also, again, that would kill perhaps 1 million or 1.5 million people, which is something you want to avoid.
Indeed. Professor Wilfred Riley, thanks for spending some time with us tonight. Everyone, his links to his books are in the show notes. Go to realclearpodcast.com to find that. Buy them, read them. They're excellent. And we'll see you here next month, Professor.
Sounds good. Thank you for having me on.